I worked really hard, but I always wanted to write. I spent all of my 20s second guessing myself and feeling really insecure. 30 hit me with a crisis of sorts. It just, you know, it felt very much like write or die sort of thing, where it was like, I have to do this.
Welcome to season 2 of Writing Stories. If you're new here, I'm so glad you're here. If you're a returning listener who's been enjoying the show, please consider rating or reviewing us wherever you get your podcasts. My guest today is Annell Lopez. Her stories have appeared in American Short Fiction and the Michigan Quarterly Review. Her short story collection, I'll Give You a Reason, is out now from Feminist Press and is the winner of the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize. In this episode, Annell talks about the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize, about boy bands, about doing an MFA while teaching high school full-time, and about the particular affordances of short story collections.
In the DR as a kid, I was a dancer, not just like contemporary music and even like, you know, American pop. It's like very much popular everywhere. So like, you know, I grew up in the DR, but like I was very much aware of boy bands, even if they were in English, like loved boy bands. Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Spice Girls, not a boy band, but you know, girl pop. Yeah. Spice Girls were like amazing. I like Destiny's Child. Oh my God, I like love Britney Spears, like Christina Aguilera, all those things from like the late 90s, early 2000s. Linkin Park, like, I don't know. Loved MTV. Very happy. Had a nice cable package that kept me very aware of American culture. 14 is such an interesting age because, well, you know, you're old enough, right? And you like, you've developed this identity, but you're still young enough to develop a brand new identity.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel, you know, I don't feel like I'm like, I know I'm from there, but I feel more rooted in my identity in terms of I'm someone from Newark, New Jersey, or I feel more like an American than I do a Dominican in that sense. Yeah. Okay. You know, I had spent most of my 20s teaching, working in a high school in New Jersey, and I worked really hard, but I always wanted to write, and I always felt like I wouldn't be able to, or like I couldn't. I spent all of my 20s second guessing myself and feeling really insecure. 30 hit me with a crisis of sorts. It just hit me with the need for something's gotta give. You know, I'm not happy. I feel like there's this thing that I want to do. You know, it felt very much like write or die sort of thing, where it was like, I have to do this. I don't have children, which is helpful in that sense, you know, makes moving and things and sort of going through those changes a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, being an immigrant in a way does help sort of you I've grown used to change in that way where like I can part ways with things. Mm-hmm. I can be new somewhere, or I can try something new, and or I can try and like be uncomfortable because I've grown up with those feelings. So mm-hmm. I felt like, yeah, the worst that could happen is status quo, which is like right back where I was. But I just hope that that wouldn't be the case. So I wrote this book while attending my MFA, but also while working as a full-time high school teacher. So it was painful. If anyone's ever taught high school or been a teacher in general, doesn't matter the grade, you know what it feels like, you know, and how it, what it does to your body and to your psyche. It's not an easy job. So my days were really long. I'd wake up at 5 a.m, you know, take care of my dog, take care of myself as best as possible, get to work by 7:10, 7:15. For a chunk of time, I taught 5 periods in a row, which is an insane teaching schedule. Then I finished my workday where I had to prep a lesson, make my copies, grade, call parents, be a decent human for my students because they don't deserve anything less. And then leave work around 3:45 to go to UNL and sit in a library or somewhere and like do homework and then go to class at 6, get out of class at 9, eat dinner in my car. Because if I didn't eat dinner in my car, then, you know, like I'm going to eat too late and not be able to sleep. I had to be up at 5 a.m. and do that for 3 years. So it was a lot of sacrifice.
What's your elevator pitch?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll give you a reason is a panoramic sort of collection. And it deals with the lives of first generation Americans and immigrants in the Iron Bound, a very ethnic neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. It deals with people who are going through grief, heartbreak, loss, love, hope, political unrest. Yeah. I think that somewhat attempts to encompass what the collection is about.
What was the first time you could remember thinking that what you were writing might become this collection of short stories?
Yeah, I remember I took a class through Catapult, which they don't do those fiction classes anymore. But I took a fiction class and I wrote a story. And the instructor, his name is Peyton Burgess. He used to live in New Orleans, but doesn't. And, you know, he like asked me similar questions about like, what do you want? And I was like, I think I want to write a collection. I had been a reader of collections at that point. And I've, you know, I loved Danielle Evans, Before You Suffocate Your Own Full Self. Barb Johnson, More of This World or Maybe Another. Junot Diaz's Drown. The Interpreter of Maladies by Jhumpa Lahiri. So those were the things that I gravitated towards. And those were the things that I loved reading. So I believed in the power of that form in terms of what it can do.
So what do you think that form does that a novel can't do? Like, what is special to the short story collection that you appreciate and wanted to emulate?
Gives you the ability to explore whatever you want to explore. And it gives you range. All the characters can be vastly different. And we can be in the same world in a way that I don't know that a novel can do, right? Like, there's only so many different things that can happen in a novel before you begin to wonder, where are we going? What is this? You know, I feel like the novel in and of itself is a more, you know, has already laid out, you know, in its topography, a more direct path that I think the collection does not need to do that. I think the collection can be expansive. Like if you read Deesha Filial's, The Secret Life of Church Ladies, it's a collection that is very tight. You know, you see the themes, but you have a vast cast of characters and it allows you to see whatever the theme is that in this case, the secret life of church ladies and sexuality and things like that from so many different perspectives. So I think that the collection it's just expansive if the writer wants it to be. And I don't know that the novel, I might end up changing my mind about this later, but I really don't know that the novel can quite do that the way that a good collection can do that. You know what? No, I'm not changing my mind. This is the hill that I will die on. I stand by this.
You've convinced me.
The collection really does have the ability to, it gives you more to do, you know? If you wanted to write about, I guess, in my specific collection, immigration, we can look at it from the perspective of someone young, from the perspective of someone old, for someone to whom it means nothing, for someone to whom it means the world. There are very few limitations. You know, I can really explore something and I can go large, you know, I can stay small, but I can also be expansive. And I really think that the collection has that power, you know, especially if the stories are very, you know, very tight and in conversation with one another. They explore, you know, multiple perspectives of the same thing.
As yours does. So, okay. So you were in this Catapult class and you had read a lot of short story collections that you really liked. Okay. So then what happened?
Yeah, I had a phone call with my instructor, Peyton Burgess, and we're talking about writing. And like I mentioned, wanting to write a collection, he said something along the lines of, you know, try to stay cohesive, you know, as you are going into it. And I thought about it and I'm like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think that later on, I've learned that a lot of people will write stories and then sort of shape them into a collection. But all that goes to say, I knew I wanted to write about Newark and I knew that I was going to try my hardest at staying, you know, within this frame of cohesiveness. And I wanted the collection to feel that way. So I set out to write it that way from the beginning. So that they weren't isolated stories. They were all sort of orbiting around the same theme.
Okay. So you kind of had your theme or Newark that you wanted to have different people in from Newark. And how did you go about generating new story ideas? Like, or which story did you write first? And then how did it go from there?
I think the story that I wrote first didn't make it because, well, for obvious reasons, you know, it's the first story. There were a couple others that I'm like, okay, this is, you know, it's in terms of location, it's there. And then I think I started sort of, I don't know, I was always intrigued by my own experiences growing up in the Ironbound and the people around me and the way that people felt about Newark and just like setting in general. So I think I started a couple of stories and then abandoned them. But What Is Yours is the first story that I wrote, which isn't set in the Ironbound, but it does explore some of the racial elements that are in the collection. And then from there on, I sort of kept thinking, I want to explore the issue from the issues that I'm talking about in terms of race and, you know, love, grief, sexuality, parents and children from different angles. So I sort of, you know, started writing stories that were similar, but maybe taking like the themes from a different angle. So like, you know, in What Is Yours, it's a relationship between a mother and a daughter. And it's like kind of not a great relationship. But then you have stories like So I Let Her Be, where we have a really strong relationship between a mother and a daughter. What if I, you know, write a story about someone who sees their neighborhood being gentrified, such as Great American Scream Machine, and is dealing with her own issues of immigration versus the world as we know it, which, you know, is from the perspective of gentrifiers. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to sort of paint the picture with as much truth as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was my goal. I started sort of thinking, well, what if the opposite happened here? And then just let the characters sort of speak to me.
That's a really interesting and I think like useful move for other writers. Like what if the opposite happened, or like what's the perspective of the antagonist here? Or like,
yeah.
How many drafts of the whole collection did you write, and how did it change as you worked with it?
Yeah, I think it varies story to story. Mm-hmm. This is also my thesis for my MFA.
Okay.
So there were many drafts for many different stories. Okay. So there were stories that, you know, what you're reading is, or what you read could be maybe the 25th draft of that one piece. And there were other stories where it was just like, oh, this is just draft 8. But everything went through multiple drafts, some more than others, you know.
And can you talk a little bit about, without giving any spoilers, like when you went back to write another draft, why would you write another draft and what would you kind of be writing towards?
Yeah, totally. You know, there were stories in which I'm like, I'm not getting where I need to go right away, or this is taking too long, or I've dropped a little bit of tension here, or this doesn't feel quite organic yet, or I feel like my reader is not going to walk away with what I need them to walk away, or this ending feels rushed, or...
And then how did you think about organizing the stories into a collection?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as a general rule, you know, I wanted the stories to end on a note that felt hopeful, but also realistic. So it was, you know, the stories that would not feel a little more hopeful were definitely not going to be toward the end, that I knew for a matter of fact. And then for the beginning of the story, I wanted the story to start the collection to feel indicative of what the reader would expect. So it had to be a story that, you know, sort of grounds the reader in the setting. So we're going to be in Newark. It needs to feel like Newark, and it needs to touch upon a lot of the themes that will later come into the story. So I chose Great American Scream Machine for that reason, along with my editor, because originally the original draft began with Dark Vader, which is the second story. So there was a little switch there. Once I sort of knew where I would start and where I would finish, then we had the middle or everything in between. So I thought of how do I bookend the stories, and then what's going to go, you know, inside. I wanted to experiment with point of view. So I didn't want the reader to walk into two stories that were being told from the same point of view, if I could avoid it. Because then it would feel either to me a little repetitive, or I don't know, it felt like it would help with the range of the multitude of characters if we started with, you know, if we alternated between points of view. So you'll see, you know, the first story is being told from a third person point of view, the second is being told from first person point of view, and so on. And so that's a bit of the rhythm that I had for myself. So it was like, you know, it was like playing Tetris in a way.
And did you know about the prize before you submitted to Feminist Press? Or how did you find out about Feminist Press?
Yeah, so I was familiar with Feminist Press from having read some of their books. So I had read, at that time, Love War Stories by Evelise Rodriguez, which I loved that collection. And I remember taking notice that, you know, I was like, oh, Feminist Press, cool. And then I had read Training School for Negro Girls by Camille Acker, which was also a Feminist Press collection. So I was aware of who they were. When I did Tin House, I think that was winter of 2021, I want to say, Camille Acker, who had been published by Feminist Press, talked about the prize a little bit. And then I was like, oh, I actually have liked this press for a while. I like the books that they put out and sort of their mission and vibe. So I sent in the manuscript a few days before the deadline was over, I think. Yeah. I was like, oh, gotta get this thing in. Let's see what happens. Yes, because I remember turning down some sort of outing with some friends. So I was like, no, I gotta send my stuff in to this press.
And how did you know that your stuff was ready to send into the press?
I had been writing the collection for a while, and a good number of them had been published. So at that point, American Short Fiction had published a story, Michigan Quarterly Review had published a story, Hobart had published a story. So I had a few of them that were already out.
What did it feel like to win the prize? How did you find out? What did you do to celebrate?
I've been nonstop celebrating ever since. I celebrated. So I was, I think I got an email at first letting me know that I was a finalist. Okay. And they were trying to reach out to me because the original email where they were telling me that I was a finalist actually didn't go through, went to my spam folder. Like, how scary is that? But the good people of Feminist Press, they followed up. to make sure I was a finalist. And I was in my classroom. I was like, oh, shoot, I can't believe I'm a finalist. That's crazy. And it was really nerve-wracking. But like, I had class that afternoon. So I was like, wrapping up at work, doing like my homework. I got to go to class now. And I'll think about this when I get out at 9 p.m. to which I came out and I was just like, wow, like I'm a finalist for this. But I didn't really think, like, I was happy. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think that I would win. You know, I was trying to manage my expectations. So, which I do a lot. So I was like, oh, okay, this is great, but I will not be heartbroken if I don't win because it's all good. Everything is fine. Kept thinking about it. I got, you know, other additional emails that will let me know if I like, you know, sort of advanced. I heard back from them, I want to say in August, and it felt like a little more serious. Now, like, I had a phone call with a couple of people. I answered questions. There was a letter of intent, but I still had not been, you know, named the winner. I was still just a finalist. And then on the next round, it would go to the judges and the editor. And then it was just like a matter of waiting. Eventually, I heard back from my editor that I won the prize in December. So at that point, I actually reached out to the agent. I was like, hey, I'm a finalist. I don't know if I'm going to win, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm a finalist for this, which she was really thrilled about. But then that sort of dissolved. Didn't quite work out, but I was grateful she read my work and, you know, allowed me to tell her that I was a finalist. But yeah, I heard in December and I actually got an email from my editor asking to have a conversation on Zoom. So I was like, I still don't know. This is still to be determined. So I was like, oh my God, please don't get on Zoom to reject me. Just reject me by email. And I remember I like scheduled a call. I like reliving this moment. But I was teaching like my fifth period class. I taught Spanish and I had to call one of my friends at work. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot that they're like on standard time. I'm on central time. I need you to step into my classroom and finish teaching this period because I got to go take this phone call, which I was like, where am I going to do this phone call? So like, she's a college counselor. So I did it in her office. And then I was told that I won. And, you know, I like got off the call, screamed a little, and then had to go finish teaching. And all my students were like, what's going on? You look very happy. And I told them I won. They were thrilled. They were clapping and everything. But anyway, that's how.
They were celebrating you, your students. That's awesome.
Yes, they were celebrating me.
And then how did you and your agent sell the book?
You know, like I had already won the contest. I mean, the prize, which meant that they were going to publish the book. When I won the prize, Feminist Press put together a really awesome announcement.
And then how did you go about, do you have an agent?
I do have an agent. Yeah.
How did you get your agent?
I got my agent after I won the prize. Initially, I had sort of reached out to a few agents, not many, and I got some really good feedback. You know, people liked the collection, but they asked, do you have a novel? You know, I was also sort of still writing parts of it. I was still in my MFA. I graduated last year. I thought, you know, this feels like it should be my first book. Like I'll start writing a novel, which I did. And I did start talking to an agent who was reading, who had read the collection and liked the collection and asked me to read what I had of my novel. Hmm. So we went on this sort of conversation, dating situation. To me, it feels like you date your agent, the agent person that you're talking to for a little bit, but it didn't quite work out. I submitted the manuscript to the prize and I won it. And then it's interesting because the table sort of turned. So I wasn't looking for agents anymore. Agents were coming to me, which was really nice.
Yeah.
That's how I got my agent.
Do you have any fears about putting the book out to the world?
Yeah, I think the regular fears of, I think I was telling a friend of mine, like, this feels a little bit like I'm exposed, you know, like, you know, very writing can be so public, but also can feel so private where, you know, it's like everyone is inside of your head for a little bit. So there are those fears. You know, there's also the fears of like, will people connect with this book? Will people appreciate what I've tried to accomplish? Will people understand it? I think that the biggest fear that I did manage to conquer is that, you know, it's the fear that it wouldn't happen. Or that I wouldn't write it. And I think that I did write it. And that was scarier than anything else. It's like, am I going to be able to finish this?
Mm-hmm. So I think somebody has got to make a TV show where each story is a different episode. I think that'd be really incredible. So if anybody,
that would be amazing. Put that into the universe. That would be great. That's,
okay. So, but my last question is, how has writing and then like getting a book deal changed you as a person or an artist?
I think that it has made me a happier person. I think all of us want to live our lives in our most authentic way. Mm-hmm. And I think that for an artist, the most authentic life that you can live is a life where you get to do your art. So I am a happier person because I wrote this book, and I am a happier person because I sat down and I went through the pain and, you know, all of the work that it took to put it together. That has done a lot for me as a person. Where I'm like, hey, I can finish a project, and that is reassuring.
That's Anel Lopez, and her book, I'll Give You a Reason, is available at the link in the show notes.
And if you like the show, of course, be sure to rate us or review us wherever you get your podcasts. Keep going.